Ings staged attacks complete with mass rape and murder on their neighbors. Until the late 19th century, the Balinese had a reputation amongst traders and sailors for being vicious fighters. The word amok, as in running amok, is a Balinese word, describing a battle technique of suddenly going insanely wild against one's enemies in suicidal and bloody hand-to-hand combat. The Europeans were frankly terrified by this practice. With a well-disciplined army of 30,000, the Balinese defeated their Dutch invaders in 1848, and again in 1849, and once more for good measure in 1850. They collapsed under Dutch rule only when the rival kings of Bali broke ranks and betrayed each other in bids for power, aligning with the enemy for the promise of good business deals later. So to gauze this island's history today in a dream of paradise is a bit insulting to reality. It's not like these people have spent the last millennium just sitting around smiling and singing happy songs. But in the 1920s and 30s, when an elite class of Western travelers discovered Bali, all this bloodiness was ignored, as the newcomers agreed that this was truly the island of the gods, where everyone is an artist and where humanity lives in an unspoiled state of bliss. It's been a lingering idea, this dream. Most visitors to Bali, myself on my first trip included, still endorse it. "I was furious at God that I was not born Balinese," said the German photographer George Krauser after visiting Bali in the 1930s. Lured by reports of otherworldly beauty and serenity, some really A-list tourists started visiting the island. Artists like Walter Spies, writers like Noel Coward, dancers like Claire Holt, actors like Charlie Chaplin, scholars like Margaret Mead, who, despite all the naked breasts, wisely called the Balinese civilization on what it truly was, a society as prim as Victorian England, not an ounce of free libido in the whole culture. The party ended in the 1940s when the world went to war. The Japanese invaded Indonesia, and the blissful expatriates in their Balinese gardens with their pretty houseboys were forced to flee. In the struggle for Indonesian independence which followed the war, Bali became just as divided and violent as the rest of the archipelago, and by the 1950s, reports a study called Bali, Paradise Invented, if a Westerner dared visit Bali at all, he might have been wise to sleep with a gun under his pillow. In the 1960s, the struggle for power turned all of Indonesia into a battlefield between nationalists and communists. After a coup attempt in Jakarta in 1965, nationalist soldiers were sent to Bali with the names of every suspected communist on the island. Over the course of about a week, aided by the local police and village authorities at every step, the nationalist forces steadily murdered their way through every township. Something like 100,000 corpses choked the beautiful rivers of Bali when the killing spree was over. The revival of the dream of a fabled Eden came in the late 1960s, when the Indonesian government decided to reinvent Bali for the international tourist market as the Island of the Gods, launching a massively successful marketing campaign. The tourists who were lured back to Bali were a fairly high-minded crowd. This was not Fort Lauderdale, after all. And their attention was guided toward the artistic and religious beauty inherent in the Balinese culture. Darker elements of history were overlooked, and have remained overlooked since. Reading about all this during my afternoons in the local library leaves me feeling somewhat confused. Wait, why did I come to Bali again? To search for the balance between worldly pleasure and spiritual devotion, right? Is this indeed the right setting for such a search? Do the Balinese truly inhabit that peaceful balance more than anyone else in the world? I mean, they look balanced, what with all the dancing and praying and feasting and beauty and smiling, but I don't know what's actually going on under there. The policemen really do wear flowers tucked behind their ears, but there's corruption all over the place in Bali, just like in the rest of Indonesia. As I found out firsthand the other day, when I passed a uniformed man a few $100 of under-the-table cash to illegally extend my visa so I could stay in Bali for 4 months after all. The Balinese quite literally live off their image of being the world's most peaceful and devotional and artistically expressive people, but how much of that is intrinsic, and how much of that is economically calculated? And how much can an outsider like me ever learn of the hidden stresses that might loiter behind those shining faces? It's the same here as anywhere. You look at the picture too closely, and all the firm lines start to melt away into an indistinct mass of blurry brushstrokes and blended pixels. For now, all I can say for certain is that I love the house I have rented, and that the people in Bali have been gracious to me without exception. I find their art and ceremonies to be beautiful and restorative. They seem to think so as well. That's my empirical experience of a place that is probably far more complex than I will ever understand. But whatever the Balinese need to do in order to hold their own balance and make a living is entirely up to them. What I'm here to do is work on my own equilibrium, and this still feels, at least for now, like a nourishing climate in which to do that. 81. I don't know how old my medicine man is. I've asked him, but he's not certain. I seem to remember when I was here 2 years ago, the translator saying that he was 80. But Mario asked him the other day how old he was, and Kutut said, maybe 65, not sure. When I asked him what year he was born, he said he didn't remember being born. I know he was an adult when the Japanese were occupying Bali during World War II, which could make him about 80 now. But when he told me the story about burning his arm as a young man, and I asked him what year that had happened, he said, I don't know, maybe 1920? So if he was around 20 years old in 1920, that makes him, what now, maybe 105? So we can estimate that he's somewhere between 60 and 105 years old. I've also noticed that his estimation of his age changes by the day, based on how he feels. When he's really tired, he'll sigh and say, maybe 85 today. But when he's feeling more upbeat, he'll say, I think I'm 60 today. Perhaps this is as good a way of estimating age as any. How old do you feel? What else matters, really? Still, I'm always trying to figure it out. One afternoon, I got really simple and just said, Kutut, when is your birthday? Thursday, he said. This Thursday? No, not this Thursday. A Thursday. This is a good start, but there was no more information than that. A Thursday in what month, in what year? No telling. Anyway, the day of the week that you were born is more important in Bali than the year, which is why, even though Kutut doesn't know how old he is, he was able to tell me that the patron god of children born on Thursdays is Shiva the Destroyer, and that the day has two guiding animal spirits, the lion and the tiger. The official tree of children born on Thursday is the banyan. The official bird is the peacock. A person born on Thursday is always talking first, interrupting everybody else, can be a little aggressive, tends to be handsome, a playboy or playgirl, in Kutut's words, but has a decent overall character, with an excellent memory and a desire to help other people. When his Balinese patients come to Kutut with serious health or economic or relationship problems, he always asks on which day of the week they were born, in order to concoct the correct prayers and medicines to help them. Because sometimes, Kutut says, people are sick in the birthday, and they need a little astrological adjustment in order to set them in balance again. A local family brought their youngest son to see Kutut the other day. The child was maybe 4 years old. I asked what the problem was, and Kutut translated that the family was concerned about problems with very aggressive this boy not take orders, bad behave, not pay attention, everyone in house tired from the boy. Also, this boy too dizzy. Kutut asked the parents if he could hold the child for a moment. They put their son in Kutut's lap, and the boy leaned back against the old medicine man's chest, relaxed and unafraid. Kutut held him tenderly, placed a palm on the child's forehead, shut his eyes. He then placed a palm on the boy's belly, shut his eyes again. He was smiling and speaking gently to the child the whole time. The examination was quickly over. Kutut handed the boy back to his parents, and the people soon left with a prescription and some holy water. Kutut told me he'd asked the parents about the circumstances of the boy's birth, and had discovered the child had been born under a bad star, and, on a Saturday, a day of birth which contains elements of potentially bad spirits, like crow spirit, owl spirit, rooster spirit, this is what makes the child a fighter, and puppet spirit, this is what is causing his dizziness. But it was not all bad news. Being born on a Saturday, the boy's body also contained rainbow spirit and butterfly spirit, and these could be strengthened. A series of offerings would have to be made, and the child would be brought into balance once more. "Why did you hold your hand on the boy's forehead and stomach?" I asked. "Were you checking for fever?" "I was check his brain," Katoot said, "to see if he had evil spirits in his mind."
"What kind of evil spirits?"
"Liss," he said, "I am Balinese. I believe from black magic. I believe evil spirit come out of rivers and hurt people."
"Did the boy have evil spirits?"
"No, he is only sick on his birthday. His family will make sacrifice. This will be okay." "And you, Liz, you are practice Balinese meditation every night? Keep mind and heart clean?"
"Every night," I promised.
"You learn to smile even in your liver?"
"Even in my liver, Katoot. Big smile in my liver."
"Good. This smile will make you beautiful woman. This will give you power of to be very pretty. You can use this power, pretty power, to get what you want in life."
"Pretty power." I repeat the phrase, loving it, like a meditating Barbie. "I want pretty power."
"You are still practice Indian meditation too?"
"Every morning."
"Good. Don't forget your yoga. Beneficial to you. Good for you to keep practice both ways of meditation, Indian and Balinese. Both different, but good in equal way. Same, same. I think about religion, most of it is same, same."
"Not everybody thinks so, Katoot. Some people like to argue about God."
"Not necessary," he said. "I have good idea, for if you meet some person from different religion and he wants to make argument about God, my idea is you listen to everything this man say about God, never argue about God with him. Best thing to say is, I agree with you. Then you go home, pray what you want. This is my idea for people to have peace about religion."
Katoot keeps his chin lifted all the time, I've noticed, his head held a little bit back, sort of quizzical and elegant at the same time. Like a curious old king, he looks at the whole world from above his nose. His skin is lustrous, golden brown. He's almost totally bald, but makes up for it with exceptionally long and feathery eyebrows, which look eager to take flight. Except for his missing teeth and his burn-scarred right arm, he seems in perfect health. He told me that he was a dancer in his youth for the temple ceremonies and that he was beautiful back then. I believe it. He eats only one meal a day, a typically simple Balinese dish of rice mixed with either duck or fish. He likes to drink one cup of coffee with sugar every day, mostly just to celebrate the fact that he can afford coffee and sugar. You, too, could easily live to 105 on this diet. He keeps his body strong, he says, by meditating every night before sleep and by pulling the healthy energy of the universe into his core. He says that the human body is made of nothing more or less than the five elements of all creation, water, apa, fire, tejo, wind, vayu, sky, akasa, and earth, prithvi. And all you have to do is concentrate on this reality during meditation, and you will receive energy from all these sources, and you will stay strong. Demonstrating his occasionally very accurate ear for English idiom, he said, "The microcosm becomes the macrocosm. You, microcosm, will become same as universe, macrocosm." He was so busy today, crowded with Balinese patients who were stacked up all over his courtyard like cargo crates, all of them with babies or offerings in their laps. He had farmers and businessmen there, fathers and grandmothers. There were parents with babies who weren't keeping their food down, and old men haunted by black magic curses. There were young men tossed by aggression and lust, and young women looking for love matches, while suffering children complained about their rashes. Everyone out of balance. Everyone needing equilibrium restored. The mood of the courtyard of Katoot's home is always one of total patience, though. Sometimes people must wait for 3 hours before Katoot gets a chance to take care of them, but they never so much as tap their feet or roll their eyes in exasperation. Extraordinary, too, is the way the children wait, leaning up against their beautiful mothers, playing with their own fingers to pass the time. I'm always amused later when it turns out that these same tranquil children, have been brought over to Sikatut because the mother and father have decided that the child is too naughty and needs a cure. That little girl, that little 3-year-old girl who was sitting silently in the hot sun for 4 straight hours without complaint or snack or toy, she's naughty? I wish I could say, people, you want to see naughty? I'll take you to America, show you some kids that'll have you believing in Ritalin. But there's just a different standard here for good behavior in children. Kitut treated all the patients obligingly, one after another, seemingly unconcerned by the passage of time, giving all exactly the attention they needed, regardless of who was waiting to be seen next. He was so busy, he didn't even get his one meal at lunchtime, but stayed glued to his porch, obliged by his respect for God and his ancestors, to sit there for hours on end, healing everyone. By evening, his eyes looked as tired as the eyes of a Civil War field surgeon. His last patient of the day had been a deeply troubled middle-aged Balinese man, complaining that he had not slept well in weeks. He was being haunted, he said, by a nightmare of drowning in 2 rivers at the same time. Until this evening, I still wasn't sure what my role was in Kitut Liair's life. Every day, I've been asking him if he's really sure he wants me around, and he keeps insisting that I must come and spend time with him. I feel guilty taking up so much of his day, but he always seems disappointed when I leave at the end of the afternoon. I'm not teaching him any English, not really. Whatever English he already learned however many decades ago has been cemented into his mind by now, and there isn't much space for correction or new vocabulary. It's all I can do to get him to say nice to see you when I arrive, instead of nice to meet you. Tonight, when his last patient had left and Kitut was exhausted, looking ancient from the weariness of service, I asked him whether I should go now and let him have some privacy, and he replied, "I always have time for you." Then he asked me to tell him some stories about India, about America, about Italy, about my family. That's when I realized that I am not Kitut Liair's English teacher, nor am I exactly his theological student, but I am the merest and simplest of pleasures for this old medicine man. I am his company. I'm somebody he can talk to because he enjoys hearing about the world, and he hasn't had much of a chance to see it. In our hours together on this porch, Kitut has asked me questions about everything from how much cars cost in Mexico to what causes AIDS. I did my best with both topics, though I believe there are experts who could have answered with more substance. Kitut has never been off the island of Bali in his life. He has spent very little time, actually, off this porch. He once went on a pilgrimage to Mount Agung, the biggest and most spiritually important volcano in Bali, but he said the energy was so powerful there he could scarcely meditate for fear he might be consumed by sacred fire. He goes to the temples for the big important ceremonies, and he is invited to his neighbors' homes to perform weddings or coming-of-age rituals. But most of the time, he can be found right here, cross-legged upon this bamboo mat, surrounded by his great-grandfather's palm-leaf medical encyclopedias, taking care of people, mollifying demons, and occasionally treating himself to a cup of coffee with sugar. "I had a dream from you last night," he told me today. "I had a dream you are riding your bicycle anywhere." Because he paused, I suggested a grammatical correction. "Do you mean you had a dream I was riding my bicycle everywhere?" "Yes, I dreamed last night you are riding your bicycle anywhere and everywhere. You are so happy in my dream, all over world. You are riding your bicycle, and I following you." Maybe he wishes he could. "Maybe you can come see me someday in America, Kitut," I said. "Can't, Liz." He shook his head, cheerfully resigned to his destiny. "Don't have enough teeth to travel on airplane." 82. As for Kitut's wife, it takes me a while to align myself with her. Nyomo, as he calls her, is big and plump, with a stiff hip limp and teeth stained red by chewing on betel nut tobacco. Her toes are painfully crooked from arthritis. She has a shrewd eye. She was scary to me from the first sight. She's got that fierce old lady vibe you see sometimes in Italian widows and righteous black church-going mamas. She looks like she'd whoop your hide for the slightest of misdemeanors. She was blatantly suspicious of me at first. Who is this flamingo traipsing through my house every day? She would stare at me from inside the sooty shadows of her kitchen, unconvinced as to my right to exist. I would smile at her, and she'd just keep staring, deciding whether she should chase me out with a broomstick or not. But then something changed. It was after the whole photocopy incident. Cotutliere has all these piles of old lined notebooks and ledgers filled with tiny little handwriting of ancient Balinese Sanskrit mysteries about healing. He copied these notes into these notebooks way back in the 1940s and 50s, sometime after his grandfather died, so he would have all the medical information recorded. This stuff is beyond invaluable. There are volumes of data about rare trees and leaves and plants and all their medicinal properties. He's got some 60 pages of diagrams about palm reading and more notebooks filled with astrological data, mantras, spells, and cures. The only thing is, these notebooks have been through decades of mildew and mice, and they're shredded almost to bits. Yellow and crumbling and musty, they look like disintegrating piles of autumn leaves. Every time he turns a page, he rips a page. "Ketut," I said to him last week, holding up one of his battered notebooks. "I'm not a doctor like you are, but I think this book is dying." He laughed. "You think it's dying?" "Sir," I said gravely, "here is my professional opinion. If this book does not get some help soon, it will be dead within the next 6 months." Then I asked if I could take the notebook into town with me and photocopy it before it died. I had to explain what photocopying was and promise that I would only keep the notebook for 24 hours and that I would do it no harm. Finally, he agreed to let me take it off the porch property with my most passionate assurances that I would be careful with his grandfather's wisdom. I rode into town to the shop with the internet computers and photocopiers, and I gingerly duplicated every page, then had the new, clean photocopies bound in a nice plastic folder. I brought the old and the new versions of the book back the next day before noon. Ketut was astonished and delighted, so happy because he's had that notebook, he said, for 50 years, which might literally mean 50 years or might just mean a really long time. I asked if I could copy the rest of his notebooks to keep that information safe, too. He held out another limp, broken, shredded, gasping document filled with Balinese Sanskrit and complicated sketches. "Another patient," he said. "Let me heal it," I replied. This was another grand success. By the end of the week, I'd photocopied several of the old manuscripts. Every day, Ketut called his wife over and showed her the new copies, and he was overjoyed. Her facial expression didn't change at all, but she studied the evidence thoroughly. And the next Monday, when I came to visit, Nyomo brought me hot coffee, served in a jelly jar. I watched her carry the drink across the courtyard on a china saucer, limping slowly, on the long journey from her kitchen to Ketut's porch. I assumed the coffee was intended for Ketut, but no, he'd already had his coffee. This was for me. She'd prepared it for me. I tried to thank her, but she looked annoyed at my thanks, kind of swatted me away the way she swats away the rooster who always tries to stand on her outdoor kitchen table while she's preparing lunch. But the next day, she brought me a glass of coffee and a bowl of sugar on the side. And the next day, it was a glass of coffee, a bowl of sugar, and a cold boiled potato. Every day that week, she added a new treat. This was starting to feel like that childhood car trip alphabet memory game. I'm going to Grandma's house, and I'm bringing an apple. I'm going to Grandma's house, and I'm bringing an apple and a balloon. I'm going to Grandma's house, and I'm bringing an apple, a balloon, a cup of coffee and a jelly glass, a bowl of sugar, and a cold potato. Then, yesterday, I was standing in the courtyard, saying my goodbyes to Ketut, and Nyomo came shuffling past with her broom, sweeping and pretending not to be paying attention to everything that happens in her empire. I had my hands clasped behind my back as I was standing there, and she came up behind me and took one of my hands in hers. She fumbled through my hand like she was trying to untumble the combination on a lock, and she found my index finger. Then she wrapped her whole big, hard fist around that finger and gave me this deep, long squeeze. I could feel her love pulsing through her power grip, right up into my arm and all the way down into my guts. Then she dropped my hand and limped away arthritically, saying not a single word, continuing her sweeping as though nothing had happened, while I stood there quietly drowning in two rivers of happiness at the same time. 83. I have a new friend. His name is Uday. He's Indonesian, originally from Java. I got to know him because he rented my house to me. He's working for the Englishwoman who owns the place, looking after her property while she's away in London for the summer. Uday is 27 years old and stocky in build and talks kind of like a Southern California surfer. He calls me man and dude all the time. He's got a smile that could stop crime, and he's got a long, complicated life story for somebody so young. He was born in Jakarta. His mother was a housewife, his father an Indonesian fan of Elvis, who owned a small air conditioning and refrigeration business. The family was Christian, an oddity in this part of the world, and Uday tells entertaining stories about being mocked by the neighborhood Muslim kids for such shortcomings as, "You eat pork," and "You love Jesus." Uday wasn't bothered by the teasing. Uday, by nature, isn't bothered by much. His mom, however, didn't like him hanging around with the Muslim kids, mostly on account of the fact that they were always barefoot, which Uday also liked to be, but she thought it was unhygienic, so she gave her son a choice. He could either wear shoes and play outside, or he could stay barefoot and remain indoors. Uday doesn't like wearing shoes, so he spent a big chunk of his childhood and adolescent life in his bedroom, and that's where he learned how to play the guitar, barefoot. The guy has a musical ear like maybe nobody I've ever met. He's beautiful with a guitar, never had lessons, but understands melody and harmony like they were the kid sisters he grew up with. He makes these east-west blends of music that combine classical Indonesian lullabies with reggae groove and early days Stevie Wonder funk. It's hard to explain, but he should be famous. I never knew anybody who heard Uday's music who didn't think he should be famous. Here's what he always wanted to do most of all, live in America and work in show business, the world's shared dream. So when Uday was still a Javanese teenager, he somehow talked himself into a job, speaking hardly any English yet, on a Carnival Cruise Line ship, thereby casting himself out of his narrow Jakarta environs and into the big blue world. The job Uday got on the cruise ship was one of those insane jobs for industrious immigrants, living below decks, working 12 hours a day, one day off a month, cleaning. His fellow workers were Filipinos and Indonesians. The Indonesians and the Filipinos slept and ate in separate quarters of the boat, never mingling. Muslims versus Christians, don't you know? But Uday, in typical fashion, befriended everybody and became a kind of emissary between the two groups of Asian laborers. He saw more similarities than differences between these maids and custodians and dishwashers, all of whom were working bottomless hours in order to send $100 or so a month back to their families at home. The first time the cruise ship sailed into New York Harbor, Uday stayed up all night, perched on the highest deck, watching the city skyline appear over the horizon, heart hammering with excitement. Hours later, he got off the ship in New York and hailed a yellow cab, just like in the movies. When the recent African immigrant driving the taxi asked where he'd like to go, Uday said, "Anywhere, man, just drive me around. I want to see everything." A few months later, the ship came to New York City again, and this time, Uday disembarked for good. His contract was up with the cruise line, and he wanted to live in America now. He ended up in suburban New Jersey, of all places, living for a while with an Indonesian man he'd met on the ship. He got a job in a sandwich shop at the mall. Again, 10 to 12-hour days of immigrant-style labor, this time working with Mexicans, not Filipinos. He learned better Spanish those first few months in America than English. In his rare moments of free time, Uday would ride the bus into Manhattan and just wander the streets, still so speechlessly infatuated with the city. A town he describes today as the place which is the most full of love in the entire world. Somehow, again, that smile, he met up in New York City with a crowd of young musicians from all over the world, and he took to playing guitar with them, jamming all night with talented kids from Jamaica, Africa, France, Japan. And at one of those gigs, he met Anne, a pretty blonde from Connecticut, who played bass. They fell in love, they they got married, they found an apartment in Brooklyn, and they were surrounded by groovy friends who all went on road trips together down to the Florida Keys. Life was just unbelievably happy. His English was quickly impeccable. He was thinking about going to college. On September 11th, Uday watched the towers fall from his rooftop in Brooklyn. Like everyone else, he was paralyzed with grief at what had happened. How could somebody inflict such an appalling atrocity on the city that is the most full of love of anywhere in the world? I don't know how much attention Uday was paying when the U.S. Congress subsequently passed the Patriot Act in response to the terrorist threat, legislation which included draconian new immigration laws, many of which were directed against Islamic nations such as Indonesia. One of these provisions demanded that all Indonesian citizens living in America register with the Department of Homeland Security. The telephones started ringing as Uday and his young Indonesian immigrant friends tried to figure out what to do. Many of them had overstayed their visas and were afraid that registering would get them deported. On the other hand, they were afraid not to register, thereby behaving like criminals. Presumably, the fundamentalist Islamic terrorists roaming around America ignored this registration law, but Uday decided that he did want to register. He was married to an American, and he wanted to update his immigration status and become a legal citizen. He didn't want to live in hiding. He and Anne consulted all kinds of lawyers, but nobody knew how to advise them. Before 9/11, there would have been no problem. Uday, now married, could just go to the immigration office, update his visa situation, and begin the process of gaining citizenship. But now, who knew? The laws haven't been tested yet, said the immigration lawyers. The laws will be tested on you. So Uday and his wife had a meeting with a nice immigration official and shared their story. The couple were told that Uday was to come back later that same afternoon for a second interview. They should have been wary then. Uday was strictly instructed to return without his wife, without a lawyer, and carrying nothing in his pockets. Hoping for the best, he did return alone and empty-handed to the second interview. And that's when they arrested him. They took him to a detention center in Elizabeth, New Jersey, where he stayed for weeks amongst a vast crowd of immigrants, all of whom had recently been arrested under the Homeland Security Act, many of whom had been living and working in America for years, most of whom didn't speak English. Some had been unable to contact their families upon their arrests. They were invisible in the detention center. Nobody knew they existed anymore. It took a near-hysterical Anne days to find out where her husband had been taken. What Uday remembers most about the detention center was the dozen coal-black, thin, and terrified Nigerian men who had been found on a freight ship inside a steel shipping crate. They had been hiding in that container at the bottom of that ship for almost a month before they were discovered, trying to get to America, or anywhere. They had no idea now where they were. Their eyes were so wide, Uday said, it looked like they were still being blinded with spotlights. After a period of detention, the U.S. government sent my Christian friend Uday, now an Islamic terrorist suspect, apparently, back to Indonesia. This was last year. I don't know if he's ever going to be allowed anywhere near America again. He and his wife are still trying to figure out what to do with their lives now. Their dreams hadn't called for living out their lives in Indonesia. Unable to cope with Jakarta's slums after having lived in the first world, Uday came to Bali to see if he could make a living here, though he's having trouble being accepted into this society because he isn't Balinese, he's from Java, and the Balinese don't like the Javanese one bit, thinking of them all as thieves and beggars. So Uday encounters more prejudice here, in his own nation of Indonesia, than he ever did back in New York. He doesn't know what to do next. Maybe his wife, Anne, will come and join him here. Then again, maybe not. What's here for her? Their young marriage, now conducted entirely by email, is on the rocks. He's so out of place here, so disoriented. He's more of an American than he is anything else. Uday and I use the same slang, we talk about our favorite restaurants in New York, and we like all the same movies. He comes over to my house in the evenings, and I get him beers, and he plays me the most amazing songs on his guitar. I wish he were famous. If there was any fairness, he would be so famous by now. He says, "Dude, why is life all crazy like this?" 84. Katut, why is life all crazy like this? I asked my medicine man the next day. He replied, Buta iwa, buta dewa. What does that mean? Man is a demon, man is a god, both true. This was a familiar idea to me. It's very Indian, very yogic. The notion is that human beings are born, as my guru has explained many times, with the equivalent potential for both contraction and expansion. The ingredients of both darkness and light are equally present in all of us, and then it's up to the individual, or the family, or the society, to decide what will be brought forth, the virtues or the malevolence. The madness of this planet is largely a result of the human being's difficulty in coming into virtuous balance with himself. Lunacy, both collective and individual, results. So what can we do about the craziness of the world? I asked. Nothing, Katut laughed, but with a dose of kindness. This is nature of world. This is destiny. Worry only about your craziness. Make you in peace. But how should we find peace within ourselves? I asked. Meditation, he said. Purpose of meditation is only happiness and peace. Very easy. Today I will teach you a new meditation, make you even better person. It's called Four Brothers Meditation. Katut went on to explain that the Balinese believe we are each accompanied at birth by four invisible brothers who come into the world with us and protect us throughout our lives. When the child is in the womb, her four siblings are even there with her. They are represented by the placenta, the amniotic fluid, the umbilical cord, and the yellow waxy substance that protects an unborn baby's skin. When the baby is born, the parents collect as much of these extraneous birthing materials as possible, placing them in a coconut shell and burying it by the front door of the family's house. According to the Balinese, this buried coconut is the holy resting place of the four unborn brothers, and that spot is tended to forever, like a shrine. The child is taught from earliest consciousness that she has these four brothers with her in the world wherever she goes, and that they will always look after her. The brothers inhabit the four virtues a person needs in order to be safe and happy in life: intelligence, friendship, strength, and, I love this one, poetry. The brothers can be called upon in any critical situation for rescue and assistance. When you die, your four spirit brothers collect your soul and bring you to heaven. Today, Katut told me that he's never taught any Westerner the Four Brothers Meditation yet, but he thinks I am ready for it. First, he taught me the names of my invisible siblings, Angopati, Marajopati, Banaspati, and Banaspati Rajo. He instructed me to memorize these names and to ask for the help of my brothers throughout my life whenever I need them. He says I don't have to be formal when I speak to them, the way we are formal when we pray to God. I'm allowed to speak to my brothers with familiar affection because it's just your family. He tells me to say their names as I'm washing myself in the morning and they will join me. Say their names again every time before I eat and I will include my brothers in the enjoyment of the meal. Call on them before I go to sleep saying, I am sleeping now, so you must stay awake and protect me, and my brothers will shield me through the night, stop demons and nightmares. That's good, I told him, because I have a problem sometimes with nightmares. What nightmares? I explained to the medicine man that I've been having the same horrible nightmare since childhood, namely, that there is a man with a knife standing next to my bed. This nightmare is so vivid, the man is so real, that it sometimes makes me scream out in fear. It leaves my heart pounding every time, and has never been fun for those who share my bed either. I've been having this nightmare every few weeks for as long as I can remember. I told this to Katut, and he told me I had been misunderstanding the vision for years. The man with the knife in my bedroom is not an enemy. He's just one of my four brothers. He's the spirit brother who represents strength. He's not there to attack me, but to guard me while I sleep. I'm probably waking up because I'm sensing the commotion of my spirit brother fighting away some demon who might be trying to hurt me. It is not a knife my brother is carrying, but a kris, a small, powerful dagger. I don't have to be afraid. I can go back to sleep, knowing I am protected. You lucky, Katut said. Lucky you can see him. Sometimes I see my brothers in meditation, but very rare for a regular person to see like this. I think you have big spiritual power. I hope maybe someday you become medicine woman.
Okay, I said, laughing, but only if I can have my own TV series. He laughed with me, not getting the joke, of course, but loving the idea that people make jokes. Gutuk then instructed me that whenever I speak to my four spirit brothers, I must tell them who I am so they can recognize me. I must use the secret nickname they have for me. I must say, I am Lago Prano. Lago Prano means happy body. I rode my bicycle back home, pushing my happy body up the hills toward my house in the late afternoon sun. On my way through the forest, a big male monkey dropped out of a tree right in front of me and bared his fangs at me. I didn't even flinch. I said, "Back off, Jack. I got four brothers protecting my ass." And I just rode right on by him. 85. Although the next day, protective brothers notwithstanding, I did get hit by a bus. It was a sort of a smallish bus, but nevertheless, it did knock me off my bicycle as I was cruising down the shoulderless road. I got tossed into a cement irrigation ditch. About 30 Balinese people on motorcycles stopped to help me, having witnessed the accident. The bus was long gone, and everyone invited me to their house for tea or offered to drive me to the hospital. They all felt so bad about the whole incident. It wasn't that serious a wreck, though, considering what it might have been. My bicycle was fine, although the basket was bent, and my helmet was cracked. Better the helmet than the head in such cases. The worst of the damage was a nasty cut on my knee, full of bits of pebbles and dirt, that proceeded, over the next few days in the moist tropical air, to become nastily infected. I didn't want to worry him, but a few days later I finally rolled up my pants leg on Catutlier's porch, peeled off the yellowing bandage, and showed my wound to the old medicine man. He peered at it, concerned. "Infect," he diagnosed. "Painful." "Yes," I said. "You should go see doctor." This was a little surprising. Wasn't he the doctor? But for some reason, he didn't volunteer to help, and I didn't push it. Maybe he doesn't administer medication to Westerners, or maybe Catut just had a secret hidden master plan, because it was my banged-up knee that allowed me in the end to meet Wyan. And from that meeting, everything that was meant to happen, happened. 86. Wyan Nuriasi is, like Catutlier, a Balinese healer. There are some differences between them, though. He's elderly and male. She's a woman in her late 30s. He's more of a priestly figure, somewhat more mystical, while Wyan is a hands-on doctor, mixing herbs and medications in her own shop and taking care of patients right there on the premises. Wyan has a little storefront shop in the center of Ubud called Traditional Balinese Healing Center. I'd ridden my bike past it many times on my way down to Catut's, noticing it because of all the potted plants outside the place, and because of the blackboard with a curious handwritten advertisement for the multivitamin lunch special. But I'd never gone into the place before my knee got messed up. After Catut sent me to find a doctor, though, I remembered the shop and came by on my bicycle, hoping somebody there might be able to help me deal with the infection. Wyan's place is a very small medical clinic and home and restaurant all at the same time. Downstairs, there's a tiny kitchen and a modest public eating area with three tables and a few chairs. Upstairs, there's a private area where Wyan gives massages and treatments. There's one dark bedroom in the back. I limped into the shop with my sore knee and introduced myself to Wyan the healer, a strikingly attractive Balinese woman with a wide smile and shiny black hair down to her waist. There were two shy young girls hiding behind her in the kitchen who smiled when I waved to them, then ducked away again. I showed Wyan my infected wound and asked if she could help. Soon Wyan had water and herbs boiling up on the stove and was making me drink jamu, traditional Indonesian homemade medicinal concoctions. She placed the hot green leaves on my knee, and it started to feel better immediately. We got to talking. Her English was excellent. Because she is Balinese, she immediately asked me the three standard introductory questions,
Where are you going today? Where are you coming from? And are you married? When I told her I wasn't married, not yet, she looked taken aback. Never been married? She asked. No, I lied. I don't like lying, but I generally have found it's easier not to mention divorce to the Balinese because they get so upset about it. Really never been married? She asked again, and she was looking at me with great curiosity now. Honestly, I lied, I've never been married. You sure? This was getting weird. I'm totally sure. Not even once? She asked. Okay, so she can see through me. Well, I confessed, there was that one time. And her face cleared like, yes, I thought as much. She asked, divorced? Yes, I said, ashamed now. Divorced. I could tell you I divorced. It's not very common here, is it? I said. But me too, said Wyan, entirely to my surprise. Me too divorced. You? I did everything I could, she said. I try everything before I got a divorce, praying every day. But I had to go away from him. Her eyes filled up with tears, and the next thing you knew, I was holding Wyan's hand, having just met my first Balinese divorcee, and I was saying, I'm sure you did the best you could, sweetie. I'm sure you tried everything. Divorce is too sad, she said. I agreed. I stayed there in Wyan's shop for the next 5 hours, talking with my new best friend about her troubles. She cleaned up the infection in my knee as I listened to her story. Wyan's Balinese husband, she told me, was a man who drink all the time, always gamble, lose all our money, then beat me when I don't give him more money for to drink and gamble. She said, he beat me into the hospital many times. She parted her hair, showed me the scars on her head, and said, this is from when he hit me with motorcycle helmet. Always he was hitting me with this motorcycle helmet when he is drinking, when I don't make money. He hit me so much I go unconscious, dizzy, can't see. I think it is lucky I am healer, my family are healers, because I know how to heal myself after he beats me. I think if I was not healer, I would lose my ears, you know, not be able to hear things anymore, or maybe lose my eye, not be able to see. She left him, she told me, after he beat her so severely, that I lose my baby, my second child, the one in my belly. After which incident, their firstborn child, a bright little girl with the nickname of Tutti, said, I think you should get a divorce, Mommy. Every time you go to the hospital, you leave too much work around the house for Tutti. Tutti was 4 years old when she said this. To exit a marriage in Bali leaves a person alone and unprotected in ways that are almost impossible for a Westerner to imagine. The Balinese family unit, enclosed within the walls of a family compound, is merely everything. 4 generations of siblings, cousins, parents, grandparents, and children, all living together in a series of small bungalows surrounding the family temple, taking care of each other from birth to death. The family compound is the source of strength, financial security, health care, daycare, education, and, most important to the Balinese, spiritual connection. The family compound is so vital that the Balinese think of it as a single living person. The population of a Balinese village is traditionally counted not by the number of individuals, but by the number of compounds. The compound is a self-sustaining universe, so you don't leave it. Unless, of course, you are a woman, in which case you move only once, out of your father's family compound and into your husband's. When this system works, which it does in this healthy society almost all the time, it produces the most sane, protected, calm, happy, and balanced human beings in the world. But when it doesn't work, as with my new friend Wyan, the outcasts are lost in airless orbit. Her choice was either to stay in the family compound safety net with a husband who kept putting her in the hospital, or save her own life and leave, which left her with nothing. Well, not exactly nothing, actually. She did take with her an encyclopedic knowledge of healing, her goodness, her work ethic, and her daughter Tutti, whom she had to fight hard to keep. Bali is a patriarchy to the end. In the rare case of divorce, the children automatically belong to the father. To get Tutti back, Wyan had to hire a lawyer, whom she paid with every single thing she had. I mean, everything. She sold off not only her furniture and jewelry, but also her forks and spoons, her socks and shoes, her old washcloths and half-burned candles. Everything went to pay that lawyer. But she did get her daughter back in the end, after a 2-year battle. Wyan is just lucky Tutu was a girl. If she'd been a boy, Wyan never would have seen the kid again. Boys are much more valuable. For the last few years now, Wyan and Tutu have been living on their own, all alone in the beehive of Bali, moving from place to place every few months as money comes and goes, always sleepless with worry about where to go next, which has been difficult because every time she moves, her patients, mostly Balinese, who are all on hard times themselves these days, have trouble finding her again. Also, with every move, little Tutu has to be pulled out of school. Tutu was always first in her class before, but has slipped since the last move, down to 20th out of 50 children. In the middle of Wyan's telling me this story, Tutu herself came charging into the shop, having arrived home from school. She's 8 years old now, and a mighty exhibition of charisma and fireworks. This little cherry bomb of a girl, pigtailed and skinny and excited, asked me in lively English if I'd like to eat lunch, and Wyan said, "I forgot, you should have lunch." And the mother and daughter rushed into their kitchen and, with the help of the 2 shy young girls hiding back there, produced sometime later the best food I'd tasted yet in Bali. Little Tutu brought out each course of the meal with a bright-voiced explanation of what was on the plate, wearing a huge grin, generally just being so peppy she should have been spinning a baton. "Turmeric juice for keep clean the kidneys," she announced. "Seaweed for calcium. Tomato salad for vitamin D. Mixed herbs for not get malaria." Finally, I said, "Tutu, where did you learn to speak such good English?" "From a book," she proclaimed. "I think you are a very clever girl," I informed her. "Thank you," she said, and did a spontaneous little happy dance. "You are a very clever girl, too." Balinese kids aren't normally like this, by the way. They're usually all quiet and polite, hiding behind their mother's skirts. Not Tutu. She was all show biz. She was all show and tell. "I will see you my books," Tutu sang, and hurtled up the stairs to get them. "She wants to be an animal doctor," Wyan told me. "What is the word in English?" "Veterinarian?" "Yes, veterinarian. But she has many questions about animals I don't know how to answer. She says, 'Mommy, if somebody brings me a sick tiger, do I bandage its teeth first so it doesn't bite me? If a snake gets sick and needs medicine, where's the opening?' I don't know where she gets these ideas. I hope she can go to university." Tutu careened down the stairs, arms full of books, and zinged herself into her mother's lap. Wyan laughed and kissed her daughter, all the sadness about the divorce suddenly gone from her face. I watched them, thinking that little girls who make their mothers live grow up to be such powerful women. Already, in the space of one afternoon, I was so in love with this kid. I sent up a spontaneous prayer to God. May Tutu Nuriasi someday bandage the teeth of 1,000 white tigers. I loved Tutu's mother, too. But I'd been in their shop for hours and felt I should leave. Some other tourists had wandered into the place and were hoping to be served lunch. One of the tourists, a brassy older broad from Australia, was loudly asking if Wyan could please help cure her god-awful constipation. I was thinking, sing it a little louder, honey, and we can all dance to it. "I will come back tomorrow," I promised Wyan, "and I'll order the multivitamin lunch special again." "Your knee is better now," Wyan said. "Quickly better. No infection anymore." She wiped the last bit of green herbal goo off my leg, then sort of jiggled my kneecap around a bit, feeling for something. Then she felt the other knee, closing her eyes. She opened her eyes, grinned, and said, "I can tell by your knees that you don't have much sex lately." I said, "Why, because they're so close together?" She laughed. "No, it's the cartilage, very dry. Hormones from sex lubricate the joints." "How long since sex for you?" "About 1.5 years. "You need good man. I will find one for you. I will pray at the temple for a good man for you, because now you are my sister. Also, if you come back tomorrow, I will clean your kidneys for you." "A good man and clean kidneys, too? That sounds like a great deal." "I never tell anybody these things before about my divorce," she told me, "but my life is heavy, too much sad, too much hard. I don't understand why life is so hard. Then I did a strange thing. I took both the healer's hands in mine, and I said with the most powerful conviction, "The hardest part of your life is behind you now, Wayan." I left the shop then, trembling unaccountably, all jammed up with some potent intuition or impulse that I could not yet identify or release. 87. Now my days are divided into natural thirds. I spend my mornings with Wayan at her shop, laughing and eating. I spend my afternoons with Katut the medicine man, talking and drinking coffee. I spend my evenings in my lovely garden, either hanging out by myself and reading a book, or sometimes talking with Yude, who comes over to play his guitar. Every morning I meditate while the sun comes up over the rice fields, and before bedtime I speak to my four spirit brothers and ask them to watch over me while I sleep. I've been here only a few weeks, and I feel a rather mission-accomplished sensation already. The task in Indonesia was to search for balance, but I don't feel like I'm searching for anything anymore, because the balance has somehow naturally come into place. It's not that I'm becoming Balinese, no more than I ever became Italian or Indian, but only this. I can feel my own peace, and I love the swing of my days between easeful devotional practices and the pleasures of beautiful landscape, dear friends, and good food. I've been praying a lot lately, comfortably and frequently. Most of the time, I find that I want to pray when I'm on my bicycle, riding home from Katut's house through the monkey forest and the rice terraces in the dusky late afternoons. I pray, of course, not to be hit by another bus, or jumped by a monkey, or bit by a dog, but that's just superfluous. Most of my prayers are expressions of sheer gratitude for the fullness of my contentment. I have never felt less burdened by myself or by the world. I keep remembering one of my guru's teachings about happiness. She says that people universally tend to think that happiness is a stroke of luck, something that will maybe descend upon you like fine weather if you're fortunate enough. But that's not how happiness works. Happiness is the consequence of personal effort. You fight for it, strive for it, insist upon it, and sometimes even travel around the world looking for it. You have to participate relentlessly in the manifestations of your own blessings. And once you have achieved a state of happiness, you must never become lax about maintaining it. You must make a mighty effort to keep swimming upward into that happiness forever, to stay afloat on top of it. If you don't, you will leak away your innate contentment. It's easy enough to pray when you're in distress, but continuing to pray even when your crisis has passed is like a sealing process, helping your soul hold tight to its good attainments. Recalling these teachings as I ride my bike so freely in the sunset through Bali, I keep making prayers that are really vows, presenting my state of harmony to God and saying, "This is what I would like to hold on to. Please help me memorize this feeling of contentment and help me always support it. I'm putting this happiness in a bank somewhere, not merely FDIC protected, but guarded by my four spirit brothers, held there as insurance against future trials in life. This is a practice I've come to call diligent joy. As I focus on diligent joy, I also keep remembering a simple idea my friend Darcy told me once, that all the sorrow and trouble of this world is caused by unhappy people, not only in the big global Hitler and Stalin picture, but also on the smallest personal level. Even in my own life, I can see exactly where my episodes of unhappiness have brought suffering or distress or, at the very least, inconvenience to those around me. The search for contentment is, therefore, not merely a self-preserving and self-benefiting act, but also a generous gift to the world. Clearing out all your misery gets you out of the way. You cease being an obstacle, not only to yourself, but to anyone else. Only then are you free to serve and enjoy other people. At the moment, the person I'm enjoying the most is Katut. The old man, truly one of the happiest humans I've ever encountered, is giving me his full access, the freedom to ask any lingering questions about divinity and about human nature. I like the meditations he has taught me, the comic simplicity of smile in your liver, and the reassuring presence of the four spirit brothers. The other day, the medicine man told me that he knows 16 different meditation techniques and many mantras for all different purposes. Some of them are to bring peace or happiness, Some of them are for health, but some of them are purely mystical, to transport him into other realms of consciousness. For instance, he said, he knows one meditation that takes him to up. To up? I asked. What is to up?